From WOSU Public Media in Columbus, Ohio, this is Classical 101's Opera Abbreviated. I'm your host, Christopher Purdy. 50 years ago, on September 16, 1966, dignitaries made their way across Lincoln Center Plaza in New York, past the New York State Theater and Philharmonic Hall, and walked into the Metropolitan Opera House, open to the public for the first time. Wallace Harrison's building, with its great arches and the Chagall murals, were nearly outmatched by the splendor of that first audience. And what did the audience hear that night? The world premiere of Antony and Cleopatra, Shakespeare's play adapted by Franco Zeffirelli, and the music by American composer Samuel Barber. Thomas Shippers, the musical brain behind this project, conducted. And as Cleopatra, the opera starred the great Leontine Price. The choice of Samuel Barber was auspicious. His solemn adagio for strings had made him world famous. His opera Vanessa won the Pulitzer Prize for Music after its Met premiere in 1957. Barber's solo cantata, Knoxville, Summer of 1915, has a permanent home in our concert halls as long as there's a warm-voiced soprano to sing. Once Eleanor Stieber had retired, the reigning American-born soprano, for whom Barber had written his hermit songs, was Leontine Price. Justino Diaz sang Mark Antony, and Leontine Price was Cleopatra. Metropolitan Opera General Manager Rudolph Bing wanted a new opera by an American for the first performance in the new Met. He wanted an opera for Leontine Price. Yet he was troubled by the choice of Antony and Cleopatra. Not one of the strongest plays, he wrote in his memoirs. To direct, Bing chose Franco Zeffirelli. Zeffirelli's productions of opera were famed worldwide, as were his collaborations with Callas, Visconti, Carignan, Fraine, and Sutherland. His production of Verdi's Falstaff for the Metropolitan in 1964 retained smash hit status. Zeffirelli knew spectacle, and he was a marquee name. Antony and Cleopatra had Shakespeare, Barber, Zeffirelli, Leontine Price, Thomas Shippers, and a brand new opera house. So what happened? The fashionable audience cheered, and the newspapers hated the production. A few years later, Donald Henahan remembered in the New York Times, a hair-curlingly awful production. The night has gone down in the annals of opera as a landmark of vulgarity and staging excess. Mr. Barber's score, as we discovered from subsequent exposure to revised excerpts in concert and on records, was to a large extent an innocent victim of the overall fiasco. Barber thought he was writing a love story. Zeffirelli had every intention of using all of the new state-of-the-art stage machinery. His sets included a giant pyramid, Cleopatra's monument, which broke the stage turntable in rehearsal. Mezzo-soprano Rosalind Elias sang in this world premiere performance.
I think he's the greatest composer, and I only felt when we were into rehearsals that it was a little too long, which they took care of. But I think it's beautiful music, and one time I think it was on television, just about opening the new house, but it didn't have the opera, didn't show it visually, but it in the background it had the music, and I thought, my God, this is gorgeous. So I mean, it's a good test. Yeah, just the music, it's so beautiful. I think the problem was the production. All those pipes couldn't understand. But I have to tell you, Mr. Bing was wonderful about it. He never interfered with the creation of the director of Zeffirelli. Never said, well, don't do this and don't do that. It stayed the way he had in visual, you know, he thought it would be the most beautiful, Zeffirelli, but it just was overproduced. And, you know, Leontine, God bless her, she's beautiful, she's tall, and then he puts a headdress on her, which pushed her right down, all of us, actually, and it sort of diminished. But, you know, it doesn't matter. The music is so beautiful. And Sam knew voices so well. Of course, he was a singer himself. He had an aunt who was a great mezzo-soprano. And he knew how to write for singers. And when Leontine opened her mouth, it just was glorious coming out. So it's a beautiful opera, and I agree with you. I love this piece. You know, Christopher, I think there was always good response. I'm not, you know, I don't remember that well, but I think we enjoyed the audience. They were enjoying it. I mean, look at you had great singers.
Right.
I mean, Leontine was the title role, and we had a lot of trouble with it's the production. The pyramid wouldn't open. Even on dress rehearsal, we were stuck in the pyramid. you know, and I think it even happened on opening night.
Mezzo-soprano Rosalind Elias, who created Erica in Samuel Barber's Vanessa and sang Charmian in the premiere of Antony and Cleopatra at the Met in 1966. Richard Dyer, in his essay accompanying the Spoleto Festival recording of the opera, writes of the first night, "The glamorous audience cheered the composer's 2 years of effort. The tragic sweep of Act III left the strongest impression. There were 14 curtain calls, and bass Justino Diaz was 26 years old when he was cast as Mark Antony."
When the powers that be decided that I should do Antony, because at the same time, before, I had heard rumors that they were thinking of Mac for the role of Antony, McNeil.
Cornell McNeil.
Yeah. And I was only 26 years old. You see. I never thought of myself as a contender, see, for that role. I heard a rumor that Zeffirelli, as well as some other people, I don't know who they might be, it could be that it was Menotti, who was writing the libretto, and McNeil would not cut a figure of the young hero, you see. And Leontine was going to be Cleopatra, of course. Mr. Bing, Rudolph Bing, had already decided that. And although there were other sopranos that were in contention, like Anna Moffo and others like that, even Callas, they thought about her. This is all things I heard afterwards. Huh? Apparently, they decided not to go with McNeil, and somebody recommended me that had seen Zeffirelli had seen me doing Samson and Delilah, Abimelech. I had the backing of Schippers, the maestro. Sam Barber said, "Well, I want to meet with him and show him the score." Now, the score that was ready were bits and pieces, and Sam we sat at the piano. I went to his apartment in New York, and he sat at the piano, and he played through a couple of pieces at the stretches of the score that I was to sing. And I guess he liked what he heard. And he tried out my range, you see, because Mac, being a very high baritone, you know, he had written a couple of high notes, you know, and he was wondering, Sam was wondering whether I could sing those. And yes, I guess I could, and to his satisfaction. And all right, we sat down, had a cup of coffee, and we talked, and, you know, he wanted to get to know me, you see. Being so young, you know, it's not that I had a lot to offer on any in any conversation of anything, you know. And anyway, obviously, he okayed the thing, all right, and he talked to Bing, and Mr. Bing made the final decision and made an offer I couldn't refuse. Okay, so that was that.
Let me ask you something about the first performance, because my understanding is the newspapers did not like the production. But did the did you feel the audience liked the opera?
Well, you know, first of all, the opera is not like an Italian opera, you know, where everybody knows what's coming, and the high note at the end of the tenor aria. You know, it's not that kind of a score at all, as you might have surmised by looking at the score and listening to the record. It is the subject matter of Antony. A lot of people have asked me, why didn't it not have the success it should have had? Your question is very, very common. And I said, well, I remember during rehearsals, we had a English diction Shakespearean coach. Philip Burton was the stepfather of Richard Burton. And he told us, as he was coaching our English diction and explaining what every line meant, because he said, Antony and Cleopatra is perhaps Shakespeare, where Shakespeare uses more puns than any other play. And the Elizabethan English, let's face it, it is not your typical thing that you can understand exactly what it means. You must be used to that kind of English, that Elizabethan English. And, you know, you'd sing my first lines of the opera. I'll try to sing a little bit. These strong Egyptian fetters, I must break, or lose my sense of adultage. I must, from this Egyptian queen, break off. You know, these strong Egyptian fetters, I must break, or lose myself in dotage. I must, from this Egyptian queen, break off. Well, as you hear, and the way I sang it, it's very fast, very confused, very full of energy. Hardly anybody can understand that. You understand that? I mean, you see that, don't you?
I do indeed. I wondered if it were done today with the titles, it would be more successful. You know, the titles.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure, my goodness. That I hadn't thought of that, and of course that would have helped a great deal. $1 million. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, we got an applause, the whole, and that huge platform. It was an enormous platform that took almost the whole stage, coming from all the way from Amsterdam Avenue. Everything was open. Of course, about a fourth of the audience could see it. You see the whole effect. Who happened to be sitting in the middle of the auditorium and not too far, you know, to the left or to the right or in terms of height. There were a few moments like that, very effective, and it was grandiose. It was so complicated because a lot of things that, flies that fly down, they were made out of metal. Aluminum pipes were cut in half, and those were the shadings. I don't know whether they come across in certain photographs. Photographs of the designs by Franco, the way he designed the production. I found it very beautiful. Of course, I lived with it since the beginning. We would get a scene, let's say, in the morning, and we would go to a pianist and learn it and almost memorize it that same morning and stage it in the afternoon.
Much of the press was hostile. What compliments there were somewhat backhanded. Harold C. Schoenberg in the New York Times called Antony and Cleopatra big, grand, impressive, and vulgar. Martin Bernheimer in the Los Angeles Times said the opera is well-constructed, eminently palatable, theatrically valid, and a bore. Rudolph Bing announced there would be no revivals after the initial run. Case closed. Antony and Cleopatra may have been done in by ugly costumes, gaudy staging, and a broken stage turntable, but few can deny its musical value. Judging from the applause on the opening night broadcast, the audience was pleased. Still, this became known as the opera that broke the Met stage on opening night. Samuel Barber revised the opera, and successful productions were staged at the Juilliard School, the Spoleto Festival, where the piece was recorded, the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and twice in recent years in Carnegie Hall. Happily, Leontine Price continued to sing excerpts of her role in concert for many years, affording us a glorious voice and the birth of an important American opera. And as Shakespeare closes the opera, and so to Rome, and so to a revival. And that's the final curtain on this edition of Opera Abbreviated from Classical 101 WOSU Public Media. I'm Christopher Purdy. For more information and for more podcasts, please go to wosu.org/classical101.